All right, and now it's time for Bicycle Talk here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch. I am here with your host, Ron Manizza, and our very special guest, Amber Pierce. Welcome, Amber.
Hi, thank you.
So once again, let's get a little bio on you and find out who you are and where you came from.
Oh, geez, no pressure.
No pressure. No, you're on. That's it. You're on.
Okay, so we'll start with my name. I'm Amber Pierce, as we just said. I'm a professional cyclist, so I've been racing at the pro level for about 10 years now. And I moved here to Mansfield just a little under 3 years ago. So I'm a relatively recent transplant, but I've absolutely fallen in love with the area. And I have to say, it's a really fun place to ride bikes.
It is a great place to ride a bike. That's the beauty of northeastern Connecticut is that it has an unbelievable number of roads available that that just kind of connect without having to get yourself exposed to a lot of traffic. And you get to see just beautiful places around here.
It's incredible.
We did a ride this weekend together, and it was actually one of my first it was my first opportunity to actually ride with you, which we've been talking about for how many years now?
Too many,
right. And I took you out on one of my favorite rides. And I think I sent you on that ride last year because you missed the ride because I was trying to encourage you to do it and you had something going on. So anyway, I took you out on my famous Mountain Laurel ride, which is I'm not responsible for the Mountain Laurels. Mother Nature is, but boy, are they beautiful, and boy, do we have a lot of them.
Oh, my gosh. And I have to say, there was a lot of buildup to that ride, and it did not disappoint.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, that's great. That's what we like to hear. So anyway, just for any of you who are ever visiting northeastern Connecticut, if you ever get a chance, there is a Mountain Laurel Preserve in the Nipmuc Forest, which is up in Union, Connecticut, and it's unbelievable. If you get a chance to, you can actually Google it, and you can go online. You can take a look at the pictures that are there. It's fabulous. It's just it's our state flower. It's a gorgeous time of the year. It only happens for about 2 or 3 weeks if you really push it, and then they're gone. But boy, are they beautiful when they're out there. And then we rode our bikes down into Kinney Hollow Road and down in the Yale Forest, which is like, it's one of those treasures. So anyway, we love living here.
Oh,
this is truly a place that is different from other areas of the country.
Oh, it's made for bicycles. It's incredible.
It is. Everyone I've ever introduced to this area, whenever they come out and visit and they go out and ride with me, they just go, "Oh my God, I can't believe you live here." And it is, you know, it's a special place. It really is. It's pretty cool. So anyway, I'm gonna drift off of this just for a minute because I need to talk about a few things. You know, this show is about bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, different things where we talk about bicycles, and I'd like to go down, just take a brief moment here to talk about a few people. Deborah Ann Bradley of Augusta, Michigan. She was the mother of two, a wife, a nurse, a runner, a cyclist, and a lover of healthy living. Melissa Ann Fevick-Hughes, 42, of Augusta. She was employed as an analytical chemist with Cubbins Laboratories in Battle Creek, and she worked as an ultrasound technician with Borges and Bronson Hospitals. Fred Anton, although also known as Tony Nelson, 73, of Kalamazoo. John Lorenz, Larry Polk, 74, of Kalamazoo. Both Polk and Nelson were involved with St. Thomas More Catholic Student Parish. They were both great human beings, and they were wonderful husbands, fathers, and grandfathers. Last on my list here, Susan Joan Sipple, 58, of Augusta. Sipple was a data manager for long-term ecological research at the Kellogg Biological Station in Michigan State University. Anyway, she was a mother of an adult son and a daughter to two parents. These folks are no longer with us. They're no longer with us because they were out riding on a group ride known as the Chain Gang, a group of cyclists that get together and just love to ride their bikes. And they were unfortunately run over by an out-of-control, we'll call him, driver, because we still don't have the toxicology report back from the situation. This happened in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It was a terrible day in cycling, and I just wanted to take a moment to bring this up and talk about the next time you're out, see a group of cyclists down the road, please give them some space. Please come around them. These are real people. I wanted to mention what these people did because I wanted to mention to them that their mothers, their fathers, their sisters, brothers, they're connected. They're in your community. They're people that help you within your community. They're community activists, and they ride bicycles. Anyway, it's a sad day. The driver was charged with 5 counts of second-degree murder. He pleaded not guilty. So we will have to wait and see how this all works out. But what I'm trying to get the point across here is to please be careful when you're out there. Remember, we're all just humans. We're going to move on from that, and we're going to go on to a little more positive note, and we're going to talk a little more to Amber about what it's like to ride out on the road with all those cars, because, you know, we've all had our issues. You know, we've all had irate motorists who are just not really happy to have us out there, and it's a tough situation. It's a really, really tough situation. So I'm sure you've had a few incidents. We all seem to.
I have. I've also had really great incidents where cars are willing to give me tons of space, even more than is necessary. And they, you know, friendly honks, friendly waves. So there's thankfully so far for me, knock on wood, the good has outweighed the bad. But there are certainly those close calls. And I think it's important just to remember that when you are in a car, I mean, it's a really big piece of machinery. And
yes, it
has
is.
The potential to be lethal. So not only for bicyclists, but pedestrians as well, and for other drivers. And, you know, we are a community, so it's important to look out for one another.
It really is. And as you say that, you know, I have to say I've had a lot of really positive responses from drivers. We had a driver the other day who just stopped and let us all go.
Yeah.
They didn't need to. It mm-hmm. wasn't their responsibility to do that, but they felt that it would be nice to let us go.
Right.
And I'm starting to see, actually, as much as I'm starting to see some problems with cars, I'm starting to see a lot more of that.
Yeah.
A lot more appreciation for us being out there, which is kind of cool because, you know, no one even knew what cyclists were 30 years ago.
Right. And an interesting point that's been coming up among bicycle advocacy groups is changing the wording from cyclists and motorists to people on bikes and people in cars, because ultimately we're all people. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, you may not know the person in the car, you may not know the person on the bicycle, but they are a person nonetheless. And as you were saying earlier about these people in Kalamazoo, I mean, certainly they are mothers, their fathers, their daughters, their sisters, their spouses, but they're also just people.
Right.
You know, and you're someone to someone, but you're also someone.
Right.
In and of yourself.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So it is really important to remember that, you know, even though we don't know the people that we're encountering, they are people, they have their own stories, and you know, regardless of that, it's a person, it's a human life. And you know, we're all here pretty much in the same boat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, it's good to look out for each other.
We are. We should be careful of one another. So you are a professional cyclist.
Yes.
That is like the coolest thing. That was like a dream, you know. I got into bicycle racing a long time ago. I was encouraged by some friends. I had just come back from a cross-country bike tour, and I had a lot of miles on my legs, and I was surprisingly strong because of that. And so I got encouraged by a couple of people to, you know, why don't you should go race your bike, see how that works. And so I did, and it was in the early days. It was a pretty funny thing. But I went out, and I had all this fitness, and all of a sudden I was, like, winning races. And,
right.
Like, hey, cool. That's really great. And what was I doing? I was riding my bike because I love to ride my bike. And
yeah.
That's the beauty of it. You have had a similar experience. You got into cycling. Well, first of all, I have to ask you one question. I have to back up just real quick. Everyone who comes on the show now, I have to ask them this one question. What was your first memorable experience, what you can first remember of a bicycle and you?
I think my most vivid memory is being a kid. So when I grew up, we lived on a cul-de-sac. And so it was really cool. We'd put little traffic cones out at the end of the cul-de-sac whenever the kids were riding bikes around the court. And so we would just do, you know, kind of hot laps around the court. And there was this one little lump of pile of cement that kind of got dried up somewhere in the middle. It was super fun. Like, you know, we'd like come at it and ride over it with tons of speed and think we were pretty cool. But really the thing that stands out for me the most is when I got to start going around the block, you know, outside of the cul-de-sac. And that was a really big deal. That made me feel like a really big kid, like super cool adult, like check me out, I'm doing my own thing here. And then of course going around the block meant that I was kind of out of sight of the house. So eventually, I like to push the boundaries a little bit. I like to live dangerously, live on the edge. So I would go two blocks away.
Oh, there we go. There we go.
And yeah. It was the coolest thing. I mean, I felt like I was, I felt like I was a space explorer. Like I was just checking out unknown territory and I was on my own. I was doing it under my own power. And it was this really awesome feeling of empowerment and freedom. And I'm telling you, people joke, it's just like riding a bike. Well, it is. That feeling doesn't go away.
Right.
Your ability to ride a bike doesn't go away. And to this day, I mean, I'm a grown adult now, I would hope. And I still have that feeling when I get on a bike. Awesome.
You were born to be a bike racer. You realize that? Here's the thing. You said that you put cones out and you were doing hot laps. I can't believe you said that. Doing hot laps on a bicycle and cones when you're a little kid. I mean, you're just born to race. That's it.
What's a hot lap?
Just a fast lap around a specific course. Yeah.
You know, like coming in hot, you know?
Yes.
Coming in hot.
Yeah. Okay. Speed. It's all about
speed. It's all about speed and, maybe pushing that edge a little bit. That's really funny. So, my dream, of course, was that I was going to, I got a hold of every publication I could from Europe. I had all the pictures from the European magazines of all these bike racers. I got into the bike racing thing. I worked my way up through the categories, eventually got up to be a Category 2 racer. Boy, are they fast. And, I got my butt handed to me a few times, obviously, doing that, as you do. I had my share of ups and downs. But the dream was, if I get really good at this, I could become a professional bicycle racer.
Right.
And that was my dream. But you live the dream. There you are. You're there. You're here. You're right here in front of me. You're a professional bicycle racer. You get paid to race your bicycle.
Yep.
That is like just tremendous. Is that difficult?
It's really hard. it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. But, it also has a flip side to that, which is it takes a lot of work. And there's, it's like any job. I mean, there are some aspects of it that are really frustrating. There are some aspects of it that are really stressful. But ultimately, I do it because at this point, the balance sheet still comes out in favor of racing bikes as a fun thing to do.
Right.
There may come a point when the balance sheet goes the other way, but, and sometimes it feels like that, to be honest. There are times when it really feels like, geez, what am I doing? This is, this is so hard and I'm making all of these sacrifices, but it's, at this point I love what I do and it's not the kind of job that you can do, through like normal retirement age.
Right.
So there's a limited window of opportunity. And for the time being, this is I just want to take full advantage while I can.
Well, it is a job.
Yeah.
That's essentially it is a job, just like we all have jobs, and there are sometimes you just love your job and you get to, you wake up in the morning and you go, wow, I can't believe I do this. And this is my job. And this is really great. And that's like such a luxury to have something like that, to be able to have that sort of thing and to be something that you are passionate about, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Really, really cool.
I don't take it for granted for a second.
Oh, no, you shouldn't. You shouldn't at all. But, the other thing that I have noticed about you is not only are you really involved with your job and bicycle racing and doing really well with it, but you're involved with a lot of things, cycling.
Yeah.
Yeah, like
well,
you have,
bikes.
You have, yeah, you just like bikes. Yeah, well, you're my kind of woman. That's it. I do too, and I live them and breathe them, and I always have, and I've always had a strong feeling towards the idea that Fran kids me about this because I say to her all the time, well, everyone should ride a bike. I don't understand why you would think any different than that, because
right.
Everyone should ride a bike because it's really fun.
It
and bringing back to that, it's fun and you get this wonderful side benefit from it. You get fitness
mm-hmm.
and you get incredible fitness when you're a professional cyclist because how many miles do you ride a year?
I have no idea.
You don't log it?
No.
Oh, wow. Really? Really?
I'm really careful not to get too caught up in numbers. Like, I use a lot of numbers and I use a lot of data to track my training and to track my progress. But what I've learned over the years is it's really easy to get caught up in that. And the fact of the matter is that, number one, numbers don't win races. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of bike riders out there, when you look at their physiological data and the numbers, you might not think that they would be that successful, and yet they go out and they crush the races. And then right. there are others who have phenomenal numbers, and you think, like, this person's going to be the next world champion.
Right.
And they're not getting the kinds of results that you might expect of that type of physiology. And so one among many things that I love about bike racing is that it requires a whole skill set, and there's a lot more to it than just the fitness. The fitness is an integral part of it, but there's a lot of strategy that goes to it, and a lot of other aspects of it. And you know, at the end of the day, I mean, riding bikes is a lot of fun. So as far as my training goes, you know, when I do a training ride, I go out and I have a time in mind that I want to do. So today I'm going to do a 4-hour ride, for example, and I have a specific set of intervals that I want to do, but I'm not going to worry too much about the distance, and I don't catalog things like that. I have a computer on my bike. So when I do a training ride, it creates a file, and the file records a lot of data. So the file records heart rate, power output, cadence, temperature, speed, a whole slew of numbers. And that all goes to my coach. And that's what my coach is for. My coach right. looks at the numbers. My coach crunches the numbers. And, you know, for me, it's more about keeping it fun and, mm-hmm. and staying motivated so that I'm ready to go out the next day and do the next set of intervals. And this is a point that I think is important to make, too, is bike racing requires a lot of discipline. But I think that there is a misconception about discipline, or at least the way that I view discipline. You know, a lot of people think of discipline as pushing yourself to do something that you don't want to do because it's good for you. But I think discipline is more about finding a reason to want to do it every day, so that, you know, you're not pushing yourself to do something you don't want to do. You're finding a way to remind yourself of why it is that you're doing this in the first place, so that when you walk out the door and you swing your leg over your bike, you're doing it with a smile and you're doing it with enthusiasm, not, look at me, look how disciplined I am. I'm going and doing this thing that I don't want to do, and it's really hard, and I'm so hardcore. Like, that's just, it's just not a sustainable approach.
You can't get all big and bad about it. Right, right. You got to be careful of that.
Yeah, you got to keep it fun. You
right,
really do.
You do have to keep it fun.
It's not to say it isn't hard work. It's really hard work, but if you can find a way to be motivated by that and to be enthusiastic about it and to be empowered by that, that's really the crux of discipline. It's a positive thing.
Right. And you know, you said something about time before, and when I'm talking to people, I'm not a professional coach at all, but I train a lot of people, with the basic knowledge that I've had over the years. I've been on my bike for a long time, mm-hmm. and I've learned a lot along the way. I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've learned a lot from it, and hopefully learned a lot from it, and I'm moving forward with that. But I'm always coaching people. I noticed on the ride that we were on this weekend, mm-hmm. you were out for a nice, easy ride, and you just never stopped coaching. You just never stopped. It's amazing. And you know, I was just, my heart was just like swelling for that. It was great because it's like, that's the reason. That's the whole reason right there. You're so into it. You just want to share everything you have with people.
Yeah.
And it's so important. It's really, really so important. But when I talk to people about it, they say, well, you know, I'm going to do this many miles and I'm going to do that. And I go, whoa, slow down. Let's go to time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, I want you to ride for an hour today.
Right.
You know, why don't we look at your long ride as being 3 hours? Let's not look at the miles, because mm-hmm. the miles don't make, they don't matter, because miles on a flat road versus miles on a hilly road are entirely different times.
Right.
So it's about the time that you spend on the bike.
Yeah. I mean, when your brain isn't ticking off the miles, your brain is just thinking, you know, about how long you've been out there.
Right. Right.
So, right. Physiologically, Yeah. But on the other hand, for some people, you know, and I have to say this, for some people, the numbers are really motivating. And getting into the numbers is part of what keeps that discipline side of it positive, because they are motivated by the fact that they've done X many miles this week and they're trying to reach this goal of X many miles. So it's not all bad. The crux of it is just to make sure that it's positive, that it's going to be a positive reinforcement thing, that it's generating enthusiasm and joy, and it's not something where you're creating a rigid set of rules that are sucking the joy out of the riding.
Right.
Well, and also that if something happens on a ride, you can change it up.
Yes.
That if
being
you
flexible.
Go out, right, if you go out and you're supposed to go out for an hour and a half and you get, you know, to an hour and you've just climbed a hill and it's a death march, it's time to go home.
Right.
See if you have a bail. And it's okay to bail.
In fact, it's
better for you to bail than to not bail.
Exactly. Because if you keep pushing through those moments, you know, and it's a balance, because there are times when you want to push through a challenge. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a really empowering thing. And that's going to be something that's going to give you a really nice training benefit, as long as you recover. But there are also those times when pushing through is really just going to dig you into a physical and psychological hole.
Right.
And to be honest, it's taken me many, many years to figure out the difference. And I still don't always get it all right. But,
right.
You know, a really important ingredient of that is to just be kind with yourself and be patient with yourself and understand that you're not always going to get it right. You're not necessarily going to log the exact perfect workout every day. And some days, if you need a bail, you just need a bail. Like a few weeks ago, I went out and I was supposed to do a really hard set of intervals. I was just not feeling it. I was really struggling to get that enthusiasm to get outside, but I got myself on the bike. And I always make this deal with myself that if I'm not really feeling it that day, I'll get on the bike, I'll get out, I'll give it 20 minutes. If I can still stand it, you know, I'll keep going and then maybe I'll try the first interval and see how it goes. And some days that turns it around. You know, all I needed to do was get out the door, get in the sunshine, and then I start feeling awesome. I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I'm out. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes I'll get through that first interval and I'll just think it's really not there. And so a few weeks ago, this happened to me. And I was, you know, starting to get really frustrated with myself. And I was going through this whole catalog of things in my head, you know, like, what could be wrong? Did I sleep okay? Am I dehydrated? And I was trying, just running through all these potential reasons for why I wasn't feeling good. And then I stopped myself and I was like, you know what? It doesn't matter. All that matters is I'm not feeling it. I gave myself a chance to turn it around. It hasn't turned around. For whatever reason, I don't feel good. It doesn't matter what that reason is. All that matters is I need to cut this ride short. I need to turn around and go home and recover and let this one go.
What you were doing is you were climbing the biggest hill. And you know what the biggest hill is, right?
Battling yourself.
The one that sits on top of your shoulders.
Right.
Right. Right. That's the tough one. Because and I know what you mean, because I've had those days where, you know, okay, I got to go and I got to do this. And you go out and you get through a couple of sets or a couple of intervals and, you know, you're just like, oh. And then all of a sudden it clicks.
Right.
And you kind of work your way through that. And then now it's like fun. Okay, how many of these can
yes.
I do?
Yes.
You know, or how many do I have to do in your case? Because, you know, this is your job. This is what you do. So you have raced all over the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Have you raced in Europe?
Yes, I've raced in many countries in Europe.
Okay, so what's the difference?
Oh, lots of differences. Language, road structure, road furniture. So in bike racing, we say road furniture.
Explain what road furniture is. I always loved that one. That's a great one.
So as you know, even here in the U.S., we have this as well. But, you know, there are curbs that may jut in and out of a road. There are manholes and potholes. There are islands. There are planters. And it seems that in Europe, most of the races tend to go, you know, from one village out across the countryside into another village, across another stretch of countryside and into another village. And you always know as you come into those villages that you're going to have lots of planters and islands and roundabouts. And we throw all of those things under this umbrella term of road furniture.
Yes.
Which is basically just potential obstacles that might cause some problems. And so it's just a really different pattern of structure. And earlier on Radio Naturopath, we were talking about how our brain recognizes patterns. And so, you know, the analogy I gave is when you learn to read, initially you have to learn the shape of each letter and the sound of each letter. And then you have to sound out each letter to form a word. And then you're sounding out each letter, forming words, and then sentences. and you're having to break everything down into these really small, detailed inputs, and your brain is processing all of that and using tons of power. But eventually, once you learn to read, you're not sounding out every letter. You're not processing every little tiny snippet of information. Your brain is actually just recognizing these larger patterns, and it doesn't have to use that much energy anymore. And you can just skim through a page of text, no problem. And that's really similar to riding bicycles. It's also similar to racing. And so as you learn to race, you learn to recognize patterns of how the riders around you are moving. What's the fastest way to go through a corner safely?
Sure.
You know, you also learn patterns in terms of teams and their strategies, you know, how a certain team races together, or what a certain rider's, you know, tells are, or how they race and what their general strategy is. And so that you can respond to what other people are doing, or even anticipate what they're doing strategically or tactically. And the biggest difference, honestly, is just that it's different. So when you go to Europe, all of these patterns and things that you have learned to recognize are completely different.
Yes.
So all of a sudden you're back to sounding out each letter again and having to relearn all of these things that you learned in the U.S. Because the patterns are different. And eventually you do get there. But at first it's very overwhelming because you're having to use all of this extra brain power to process all of this information just because it's all different. The text on the signs are different. The road furniture is different. Even in different countries in Europe, you know, the pattern of movement in the peloton is different, and the style of riding is different, and the style of the terrain is different. So getting all of that under your belt and honing an instinct that you can then carry from one place to the next is a big challenge, but it's a really fun one.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine in Europe, you know, Europe is, it's old. Mm-hmm. It's much older than what we have here. And I confess, I watch a lot of bike racing. I really love to watch bike
Imagine
racing.
That.
I'm intrigued by it. And one of my favorite things is that you'll see one of those islands, the road furniture, as you mm-hmm. call it, and there'll be a guy who's dressed in bright material with flags waving
yep.
them back and forth like he's landing an airplane.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's just like parting around him, but he's there to let you know that, you know, you got to be really careful right here because
right.
this is a tough spot. And I always find that humorous when I see the flag guy out there, you know, waving away. But, you know, all those little villages were built, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And so they're not going to change the road structures. I mean, the buildings are right on the edge of the roads in some
yeah.
of those villages. So you're like almost shouldering the side of a building when mm-hmm. you're going through, which is kind of intense, I would imagine.
Oh, definitely.
And we don't have that here because we're new and we're open and we're the United States. We're a much bigger country and we have a different layout as the way we do things.
Right. And most of our roads were actually constructed with automobiles in mind and for automobiles. Whereas a lot of the roads in Europe are, you know, they existed before cars existed.
Right.
And so they were built with very different, you know, maybe just for pedestrian traffic. And so they are far more narrow. And the other thing is that there's, at least in the women's side, but I think you could probably make this generalization for the men as well. Cycling has been a big thing in Europe for a really, really long time. So there's a greater depth to the fields, which is to say that there are usually more people in each of our races. So in our World Cups, for example, we'll have 150 to 200 women in a race. Whereas
wow.
in the U.S., we're lucky if we get, you know, 80. 80 would be a pretty big field
say,
here.
Yeah,
so
it'd be a very big field here.
So
yeah.
you imagine you have almost twice the number of people in the race, plus the roads are narrow, plus you have all this extra road furniture. It's a lot to process.
Yeah, boy, your adrenaline must be like at a much higher level when you're there because there's just so much more going on. You have a lot more, you know, there's much more stimulation.
Right. Well, it is at first. And then after a while, you realize, you know, as your brain starts becoming accustomed to this and you start honing that instinct and recognizing patterns, you don't have to use nearly as much, you know, brain energy to process everything. And then you realize it's still just a bike race. You're
it
just
is.
Racing bikes. And it's beautiful and it's strategic and it can be beautiful in its complexity. But at the end of the day, it's pretty straightforward. It's not rocket science. It's just racing bikes.
And you are the motor. You're
yes.
the one. I mean, you are the power that therefore pushes that bike forward.
Right.
That makes it all happen. So there's another component involved in there too. Your fitness is involved there. But I always tell people when they say, "Well, what's it like to race bikes?" And I go, "It's like a chess game on wheels."
Yes.
Because you have to know when to move, how to move, where to move, who's doing what. You have to, there's a lot to process when you're racing your bike. It's much more complicated, you know, because people go, oh, I went to a bike race. They went around and around in a circle and then somebody sprinted at the end. That was it. Well, that's not really the way it is at all.
Right.
Because
actually,
there's a lot going on in the inside, yes. Especially when you're sitting in the middle of the peloton and it just, you know, there's a lot of chatter. People don't realize how much chatter there is in there.
Right. And that's, I think it's the same with any sport. When you understand the strategy underlying what people are doing, and so you kind of understand why they're making the choices they're making and taking the actions that they're taking, it's far more interesting to watch. And I love your analogy of chess. It's similar to what I always say, which is that bike racing is a combination of NASCAR, chess, and boxing.
Yeah.
And the reason
I got the boxing part.
right. So the reason it's like NASCAR is, like NASCAR, everybody shows up to the line with a fixed amount of fuel, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unlike NASCAR, we can take in some fuel, we can eat and drink on the bike, but ultimately your body can only write so many checks. So you have to be really strategic about how and when you use your energy, which brings us to the chess piece, which you just said,
mm-hmm.
which is usually we're working with a team. So when I talk about wise use of energy, this is a key concept in bike racing is drafting. So if you're riding behind another rider, let's say on a flat road and there's no wind, that rider is having to fight air resistance and you're getting the benefit of their draft. And actually, if you're sitting behind somebody, you're doing 30% less work. So if you manage and just, you know, you have two people racing against each other over, let's say, 100 kilometers and rider A's in front, rider B's behind. If rider B stays behind the whole time, they're doing 30% less work over 100 kilometers.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen when you get close to the finish line? Rider A's going to be super tired. Rider B's going to be nice and fresh and they can accelerate around rider A. Well, that's a really oversimplified way of explaining bike racing tactics, because when you get into a race situation, now you've got teams, and like we might have a team of six riders. And the race is going to finish at the top of the mountain. So we're going to look at our team of six, and we're going to say, here's our chess pieces.
Right.
What are the strengths of each of these pieces? And we're going to look at the person on our team who's the best mountain climber for that day, because we need a mountain climber, because the mountain climber is going to have the best chance of winning the race. So then the rest of us, the other five of us, are going to make sure that our mountain climber is in the draft the whole time, so that when we get to that final climb, our mountain climber, our chess piece, is going to be fresher than everybody else. And they're going to have the best chance of winning the bike race. Well, that's great, but isn't every other team doing that? Exactly.
Well, yes, they are.
So
there's
then,
the next component.
Right. Then there's this added layer, right? We don't want everybody else's climber to be really fresh for that final climb either. So we're going to try to entice other teams to use energy that they don't want to use. So, you know, me, and again, we're using the example of a hilly race. I'm not a climber. Well, I might go on the attack. I might accelerate away from the main bunch. So other teams are going to watch me going up the road and they're going to say, well, either we don't do anything, we stay in the draft and we conserve our energy. Well, if they do that and I go up the road, I'm going to win the bike race. So they're forfeiting the win.
You could get away.
Right. So they're forced into this choice of, you know, do we chase her down? Do we put somebody into the wind and fight the air resistance and spend this energy to chase that down? And so what you end up having is all of these teams that are using the various strengths of their chess pieces against each other, and
right.
you know, trying to give themselves the best opportunity, the best probability of winning the bike race. And then the third layer to all of this is the boxing layer, which is, like I said, sometimes we'll have 200 women in a bike race and you take a turn onto a road that's no wider than a desk.
Oh.
What do you think is going to happen? Because if you're the last person in that group of 200 people, you know, and you're on a road that's as wide as a desk, you know, you're not going to be able to go on the attack. You're not going to be able to accelerate away from the group. You can't, as we say, you can't race from the back of the bunch.
Right.
So all 200 women are fighting to have position at the front of the bike race so
sure.
they can race their bikes.
Right.
And, you know, usually you would hope that everybody in the field is very skilled. So they might be really aggressive about their positioning, but they have the skill to do it safely. And as we all know, accidents happen. So it's not always the case, but you know, we do get a little bit aggressive about, you know, positioning and especially at crux moments in the race, things might get a little bit heated. Mm-hmm. I've definitely seen some headbutting. I've even seen some punching. Mm-hmm. And yes, this is the women's fields.
Yeah. Heavy so, leaning with the shoulders, pushing out with the elbows.
And let me be clear, you know, as far as racing etiquette goes, you're not supposed to punch your competitors.
No, you're not.
But a fair amount of, you know, we'll call them sharp elbows is certainly acceptable and probably expected. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, the crux is that you have the skill to do it safely and not put anybody at risk when you are being aggressive about your positioning.
A friend of mine raced in South Africa years ago professionally. Mm-hmm. And he's racing in South Africa, and he said that it was real aggressive and there's a lot of pushing and shoving going around. And he said this one guy at the end decided that he wanted to be up in front of the group. So mm-hmm. he took his hands off the handlebars and he pulled himself through shoulder to shoulder.
Oh, my gosh.
Through the middle of the pack. And he said all of a sudden he feels this guy pulling on him. And he's like driving. He's just pulling himself through. He's giving himself all this extra power because.
Wow.
And he said that opened his eyes to that he was not in Kansas anymore. But, you know, I mean, they can get very aggressive. And that thing that you talk about, that bottleneck is mm-hmm. what you're talking about, that yes. where the road gets really narrow. And I've been in races where, you know, that bottleneck turns into one long line.
Yes.
And you're sitting, you know, 2 or 3 inches off the back of the person's wheel in front of you. And then they're the same thing behind you. And it's this long stream and you're all going, you know, 30 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And you're hanging on for dear life.
Right.
And you're like, I can't do this for very long. And then finally somebody up front says, oh, that's it. I've had it. I can't do it anymore. And then it all bunches back up and you're back to square one and it's not so bad anymore. But those little strings like that, those really wind your legs out. And there's your strategy. If you can wind people's legs out, then they're not going to have it for later on. And
there's so much going on. Team strategy, right? So if you have a big team and you have more people on your team than other people have on their teams, you've got more matches to burn, so to speak. So
right.
you can send a couple people up the road and just attack. And everybody's having to follow them and chase them. And you're stringing out the group, like you're saying, and what you're doing is we like to call that softening up the field. So you're making everybody really tired. And then once everybody's really tired and you've got those three extra riders that have been sitting in the draft the whole time, guess who's fresh?
Right.
And then, you know, then they can go on the attack when the rest of the field is really tired. So there's all these things that you can do to increase the probability of your team winning the race. And this is a really important point with cycling. Most people don't realize it, but it's very much a team sport. So like I was describing, you know, we may have a team of six and we'll assess the terrain and the course and we'll decide which of our chess pieces has the best opportunity to win the race that day. Well, only one person stands on the podium.
Right.
So you may have a team of 10.
Right.
Who are working to get this person onto the podium. And unlike soccer or basketball where the whole team wins, only one person wins and stands on the podium in cycling. And yet you have this entire team of people behind them willing to sacrifice their opportunity for a race win or a podium spot just so that they could have one of their team members on the podium and they increase the chances of that happening. To me, it's a really beautiful thing. And when you're on a team where you have good chemistry, you know, one day you might be racing for a climber on a course that suits a climber. And the next time that climber may then in turn be doing a lot of work to support a sprinter, you know, in
right.
a race that's flatter that might favor a sprinter. And so there's this sense of willingness to sacrifice for one another. And to me, it's one of the most beautiful things of the sport because it's a true team sport because the entire team is sacrificing for one person.
Yes.
And you don't get the glory if you're one of those helpers.
Right.
But there's this really fulfilling sense of, you know, look what we accomplished together.
And isn't this what life should be about? I mean, this is why, you know, to me, it makes a lot of sense. We all work for one another and, you know, maybe I'm a little bit of a socialist. Oh, well. But, you know, we all just like work for one another and the whole team does well. And it's a beautiful thing. And it's really, really good. I think it's a more humanized sport than a lot of other sports that are out there because there is there's a camaraderie. I tell Fran this all the time. I love to go out and ride my bike, obviously, but I really love to go out and ride my bike with bike racers.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I'm going fast.
Right.
Not that I'm going fast. I just like to ride with them because they take care of one another.
Right.
Because once you get yourself into that situation where you've raced bikes for a number of years and you've gone out and you've done the work. You know, maybe you've gotten together with three or four people and you've decided that you're going to go on lap six.
Yeah.
And you're going to put it together. And you're all on different teams even.
Yeah.
But you're going to do this and you're going to work together. All of a sudden, your quote unquote enemies, I don't want to call them enemies, it's kind of a, but your competitors,
yeah.
Your competitors are now important to you.
Right.
And without them, you can't do what you have to do. So everyone learns to work together as one machine. And I don't know, maybe I'm just, I get weepy when I think of this, you know, because it's how it should be. You know,
yeah.
To me, it just, it's so sensible. You know, it makes a lot more sense. So again, I love to ride with the bike racers because the bike racers, they never leave anyone behind. They're like the Marines. You know? Don't leave your man behind.
So are you saying that Bernie is a bike racer?
I would say that if Bernie had, if we're going to get political here, if Bernie had been in any kind of sport, bike racing was probably the sport he should have been in. Yes, because yeah, he's, you know, he's socially correct in many ways, but and you know that comes through in sport. You don't see that in a lot of sports. You know, I mean, I take a look at other sports and yeah, a football team needs a team. They need the line to be able to protect the quarterback. They mm-hmm. need the, you know, they do have a team aspect to it, but it's just not the same.
There's not the same sense of sacrifice involved, I think. And, you know, talk to any bike racer and they'll tell you that pretty much the crux of the sport is suffering and discomfort. And it's almost a contest of who can suffer the most and manage the most discomfort and still keep going. But I feel like once you've dug that deep and you've experienced that incredible, you know, sense of suffering and you've seen other people experience that sense of suffering, there's a real sense of empathy that develops. And it's not just within the people on one team, but you'll even see it, you know, if I'm on my team and I'm in the position of helping my team leader, for example, try to win the bike race that day, I can appreciate what the other helpers on the other teams are doing too, because, you know, I've been there. And
yeah.
I know how hard it is, and I know how hard you suffer. And so a great example would be the gruppetto. And the gruppetto is, like I was saying, if there's a really hilly stage, and let's say it finishes on the top of a mountain, most teams are going to be working for their climbers. So
right.
all of the non-climbers are going to do a boatload of work and a boatload of suffering right up until that last climb.
Sure they are.
And if they've done their job well, they will have just barely enough left in the tank to get up that climb and still make the time cut.
So there is
a time limit, right?
Like
you can't just take 12 hours to go 3 miles.
Right.
You have to make a time cut. So the helpers, and the term for a helper in bike racing is domestique. It's an official role on the team. So the domestiques will often come into that last climb and they'll just be spent. And they'll often end up in a group together. And, you know, so these are people from all different teams. They've all done their work to help their team leaders. The team leaders are up the road duking out for the win on that day. But the domestiques are all together in this group, and we call that the gruppetto.
Oh, that's great.
And
I love it.
And in the gruppetto, you know, the goal of the gruppetto is to get up the climb as slowly as possible, but still making time cut.
Still make the time cut, right.
Because you all want to conserve energy because you know that the next day all of you domestics
are going to be
doing it again.
Yeah.
So you got to, you know, you want to conserve energy so you can have energy the next day to devote to the team. So you're looking around at all these domestics. You've all just suffered your guts out. You're going up the climb, and it's the most beautiful thing. Well, you know, you check in with each other, even people on different teams. Do you have enough food? Do you need any water?
What do you need?
How are you doing? Mm-hmm. And you'll even see people pushing each other up the climb. If somebody's really suffering or they're cramping, you'll have a couple people with their hands on their backs pushing them. And I'm talking about people from different teams helping each other up. And it's
absolutely,
it's beautiful. And then, you know, of course, if somebody in the gruppetto starts going too fast, someone will yell at them and grab their jersey pocket.
Pull them back. Yeah, there you go. Hey, enough
calm
of that.
Calm down.
Right.
We're not going for the race win.
That's
here.
Right.
Race is
That's
up the road.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So there's, you know, there's this camaraderie thing within the sport, which it is special. It's really different. And I don't think that, especially the American public doesn't see that. They don't understand it quite as much as you would if you were sitting in a Peloton like that.
Right.
But
I don't think the American public understands the concept very well in general.
Well,
yeah.
We grow up with different sports. And
we focus on different things. We definitely focus on different things for sure here in the U.S. you know, you made reference to NASCAR.
Uh-huh.
NASCAR, the most watched sport in the U.S., right?
Right.
NASCAR. right? Mm-hmm. I never understood NASCAR, and then I raced my bike, and then I went, oh.
Right, exactly. So it gets back
now
to...
Now I get it.
Right, once you understand the strategy of it and what's going on behind the scenes, then all of a sudden it makes sense, and it's actually really entertaining.
It was a lot more interesting.
Yeah.
Because now you're looking and you're going, well, he's running on the outside of the track, and he's doing this and that, and, they're looking at where the wind's coming. I mean, they're looking at everything that we look at on our bikes.
Exactly.
They're looking at the exact same thing, because they're trying to conserve fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And because, the horsepower of this one and the horsepower of that one, they're pretty much the same. You know, it's like who can do it right and still have gas in the tank.
Exactly.
And it's another game, and it's similar. And I had no idea until I raced my bike. And I raced my bike, and I started watching car racing, and I started watching motorcycle racing. And
yes.
I was like,
oh my gosh!
Oh,
I
God.
Get really into MotoGP.
I that is something I can never own a motorcycle, because I get so fascinated by the speed. And
oh my gosh!
I you rode with me. I like to go down hills fast.
Uh-huh.
I really
would be
that.
Alone.
And yeah. But there's something about it. I just get totally turned on by it. So I can't own a motorcycle, because I know I'll hurt myself. And,
it's probably a wise choice.
Yeah, probably is. And a shout out to my friend Bruce, who's also a motorcycle rider, who listens to the show. So if he's listening.
These guys are fearless descenders.
Yeah,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is the people that I ride my bike with, the ones that have motorcycle experience, they can go down hills.
Mm-hmm.
They have no problem with it at all. We just, we all just like bury it down the hill.
Yeah.
And to me, someone came up to me once and they said, how do you go downhill so fast? You're so little. You're just a little guy, and you fly down hills, and I'm much bigger, and you can just kill me on the hills. And I get a big grin, because I'm all excited, because it's fun.
Right.
And I said, well, that's the reason I climb.
Yeah. Me too.
Because it's all about the
downhill.
The downhill, the wind at your back, and the downhill.
Also, Amber showed me how to do that thing where you put one leg down and the other leg comes up, and you push one hand forward, and you get really low, and you go faster.
And the 1 foot down keeps you so that you let your bike lean into the corners, mm-hmm. instead of turning into the corners. And yeah, you're wonderful at articulating the skills on a bike. I was very, very impressed with the way you were working with people this weekend, and I don't think about it as much as you do, and I think it's just because you're still racing. I mean, you're
right.
Still doing this. So but the way that you were pointing out to, we had what, four women on that ride?
I know.
Is that what we had on
that
ride?
Really nice.
And you were just working with all of them, and they were all accepting it and learning from it. And I just think that was probably one of the most important rides I've been on this year.
Oh.
It was great.
Oh, that's really touching.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was so,
yeah. Well,
so much
come
fun.
Ride some more. Whenever you're going slow, just let me know. Because I do love to ride my bike.
Or you
can
just want to ride in nature, where
yes.
you want to go out and you want to like see some stuff.
Yeah.
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 Well, we were talking earlier about the importance of recovery and training, and it's not just about the physical recovery, so that when you're training, you want to generate what's called a training stress. So you want to challenge your body physically. And a lot of that has to do with, going harder than you want to go, or going longer than you want to go. And that results in some, training stresses. And one of those is that your muscles break down a little bit. And then if you give yourself enough recovery, you're going to what you call supercompensate. So your body is going to heal itself, but it's going to heal itself knowing that, hey, this is the challenge that we're being presented with, and things have been broken down, but when we heal them, we're going to heal them in a way that they're going to be able to meet that challenge next time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying earlier as well that I really like to view my training sessions as making requests of my body. Like, if I'm doing hill repeats, I'm telling my body, listen, I'd really like to be able to go up a hill fast. So this is what we're trying to accomplish, body. And then I go home and then I recover and I give my body a chance to say, okay, we want to go up hills fast. How are we going to adapt our physiology to be able to meet this challenge and meet this request? And so those are the training stresses that we want. And then you want that recovery so that you can adapt, come back stronger. And that's called supercompensation. But the other aspect of that is the mental recovery and the emotional recovery. So,
oh boy. Yeah.
Going out and doing intervals or in a bike race, it's really intense mental focus. So it's not just about, you know, you look at a track race or a running race or even a swimming race, you know, the gun goes off, everybody has their own lane, and you just go as hard as you can, and it's the person who has the fastest time that wins.
Right.
In a bike race, like we were talking about, there's all of this strategy. So it can be the case where you're just noodling and you're barely putting pressure on the pedals. And if no one's pushing the pace at that moment, then, and it doesn't make sense to use energy at that moment, then you need to take that moment to, you know, take on some food, drink some water,
sure,
and appreciate the fact that it's going slow and hide in the draft and use less energy than everybody else so that when it starts going fast and there's a crux moment, you have, you're fresh enough to address that. That takes a really a ton of focus and a ton of mental energy because, again, you're trying to fight for position. So you're having to be super aware of where everyone is around you. Where is the wind coming from? Where are you on the course? How much longer do you have to go? Is there a critical hill coming up? Is there a bottleneck coming up? And you need to move forward before that bottleneck. You have to be constantly aware. And even the slightest distraction can cause a hesitation and be a huge tactical error for the race. So you have to allow yourself that mental and emotional recovery too, so that you can train that focus. It's just like training a muscle.
Right. Boy, we talked a lot about bike racing, but you know, obviously I love bike racing and I want to pick your brain as much as I can here on the air, but I have a few other things on my list here that we need to go down.
We had
talked about, sponsorship. How do you get paid? I mean, think about this. You're being paid to race bike. How's that work?
Right. So it's I'll just kind of explain the general structure of how it works. So usually what happens is you have what's called a sports management company. The sports management company goes out and they find equipment sponsors and financial sponsors. So the financial sponsors give money. The equipment sponsors might give equipment and money. So equipment sponsors would provide everything from bicycles, wheels, helmets, clothing, shoes. And then the financial sponsors provide money. And from all of this comes a budget. And out of the budget comes salaries for staff and salaries for riders and travel budget. So the sports management company goes out, and this is in theory and in an ideal world, this is how it works. They go out, they secure the sponsorship. Then they have this pool of money, this budget and this equipment. And then they go out and they hire staff and riders. And so the riders are hired as independent contractors, and you sign a contract, which gives you a monthly salary, what we call a rider fee. And then, you know, your travel is also covered. And that way, when you show up to a race, you've got staff. So we have a mechanic, we have a soigneur. A soigneur is the person who makes sure that the riders are fed. And, you know, they're the ones that are in the feed zone on the side of the road handing up bottles. It's really critical.
Yes,
position.
It is.
we have directors. So that's kind of the structure of how it works. And from the rider's perspective, for me, what I do then is, you know, I talk with management, the sports management company, and we talk about, okay, what's the calendar going to be? What's the salary going to be? And then, you know, you want to ask around. So, unfortunately, the sport is not super stable at this time. So it's often the case that you don't have sponsors committing for more than a year. And you might be wondering, okay, well, what do the sponsors get out of it? It's really
advertising.
Marketing. Yes.
Right. It's marketing and advertising.
It's marketing.
Right.
So for the equipment sponsors, they're demonstrating how, you know, they get credibility.
Mm-hmm.
So look at the pros are using our equipment. Look at how well they're doing on it.
Sure.
It's obviously good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The financial sponsors are getting their brand name out there. So there's not only brand awareness, but there's an emotional branding aspect of it. You know, you want people to associate excellence with your name, or you want people to associate speed with the name, or whatever it happens to
be.
So there has to be some kind of a marketing advantage for them. So the really important thing for the athletes and for the teams is to generate return on that investment. And I'm really lucky. I actually get to work with some amazing sponsors, and actually four of them are actually based here in Connecticut. So I work with Store Center Cycle, local bike shop here, Bike Tag, Sam Sport, and Cannondale are some local ones, as well as others from around the country. But it's I like to joke that being a professional cyclist is like getting your street MBA. There's a lot that you have to learn about the business side of things.
There is. Yeah. Well, you know, obviously I've been in the bicycle industry for 41 years, so I'm
you
on the business
it.
End of things.
Yes.
I totally get it. I totally understand how it works. I can see that we are going to have you back on again another time here, because I still have things on my list that we haven't even gotten to yet. I know that you're heavily involved with Bike Mansfield.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you're president of that organization, is that correct?
I am, yes.
Okay. And I did have them on earlier on a previous show, so that's good. And you know, we'll talk about some other things too, because there's definitely a lot more. I have more to pick from your brain. So it's been a real pleasure to have you here. You have another quick thing I'm going to give you. You have like 2 minutes or less here. Network for Advancing Athletes. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a mentorship organization I've started, pretty low-key, but what we do is we pair professional, Olympic, and elite-level female athletes with active women and girls of all ages, so you don't have to be an athlete per se. But being an athlete as a woman has specific challenges, and it can be really helpful to have a mentor who's been there and can understand things from a women's perspective. So we have a really amazing pool of mentors who are very high-level athletes, but they're also just really kind, wonderful, amazing human beings willing to volunteer and donate their time to mentor other women who are getting active in sports. So, yeah, that's been really fulfilling.
Great. That's great. Well, I'd like to thank you all for listening. My name is Ron Menizzer. You're listening to Bicycle Talk here on WHUS. I am here with my co-host, Fran Storch, and professional bicycle racer Amber Pierce has been here to enlighten us on the wonderful job of racing a bicycle. You know, it's kind of funny to look at it as a job, but it really is a job. It's very, very much a job.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And we'll do this again sometime. We'll do this again real soon. I would like you to all have a safe and wonderful day, and get out and ride your bikes.